There are options for women to be able to stay in school, to get an education, and to care for their children at the same time and choose life.
Pro-life policies on Catholic campuses. The program's providing a path toward success for pregnant students and new mothers.
Very high percentage of those people living there are Christian, and they've been attacked numerous times.
Tracking gross violations of religious freedom worldwide, we look at the latest report from the U.S. Commission on International Religious Freedom and the countries where Christians are facing a rise in persecution.
I've done a lot of unhealthy self-protecting behaviors.
Fears of abandonment, anxiety, depression, and a lack of confidence in relationships. The toll of divorce can have lasting impacts, but one ministry is helping adult children of divorce heal. EWTN News In Depth starts now.
Continuing to support programs like this is what actually makes the difference.
Support for new mothers and mothers-to-be. They say it takes a village, and some Catholic colleges and universities are stepping up, not just to welcome, but to embrace and accompany unmarried pregnant students and help them flourish and achieve their educational goals. Welcome to EWTN News In Depth. We begin our program today with a special look at pro-life policies at Catholic universities. In a group reporting project across EWTN News, In Depth, National Catholic Register, and the Catholic News Agency teamed up to find out what kind of programs and aid are available for single mothers pursuing a degree on Catholic campuses. In a post-Roe world, are Catholic higher education institutions living out Catholic social teaching and supporting pregnant college students? Catherine Hadro reports.
I knew that the Lord was calling me to be a nurse, and I was going to do whatever it took.
College student Angelina Haft first felt called to the medical field when she was just 10 years old. But last year, she had to change her plans.
I was working on my nursing degree back in Texas, and I found out I was pregnant.
She thought her dream of being a full-time student and becoming a nurse was no longer an option. Until she heard Monsignor James Shea, the president of the University of Mary in North Dakota, on the radio, talking about a new program.
It was definitely a light at the end of the tunnel for me.
She applied for the program and soon headed to Bismarck, just 3 weeks after having her son, Augustine. Juggling school and parenthood is not easy, but she thanks God for the opportunity.
It's definitely such a blessing to know that I can go to a university, because that was one of the things I thought about when I found out I was pregnant, because I had these ideas in mind how I wanted to go into the medical field.
This program, called the St. Teresa of Calcutta Community for Mothers, is a brand new University of Mary initiative. The living quarters can fit 20 students. While the program has been in the works for a few years, Monsignor Shea says the overturning of Roe v. Wade in 2022 became the call to action.
Whatever happens at this sort of this watershed moment around this very contentious issue in American politics, what we need to do as men and women of faith here at the University of Mary is think about how we can witness to the pro-life cause in a very tangible way.
Through this program, the university provides tangible support, like special housing and financial support. Young mothers even receive free childcare provided by other students. In its first year, the St. Teresa of Calcutta program welcomed two young women, Angelina and Katie, who was already a student at the university. She found out she was pregnant during her sophomore year.
I was pretty sick, and it kind of just shot my confidence down that I could go back to school and like all this stuff with, if I couldn't even handle being pregnant and going to school, you know, how could I do it with a baby?
For her, the support from her peers in the college community encouraged her to continue her education while raising her daughter.
The confidence that the other students gave me helped me to come back this past fall. And I was so excited to start the program and just to be able to live on campus again. and be a college student with, an extra person with me.
According to a 2021 study from the Institute for Women's Policy Research, more than half of undergraduate student parents suspend their enrollment without returning to complete their program, compared to only a third of students without children. In light of the overturning of Roe and a re-examination of the level of support for pregnant women and families, EWTN News In Depth and our sister publications, Catholic News Agency and the National Catholic Register, polled 64 Catholic colleges around the United States, many large and well-known, others small and regional. We asked what resources they provide for pregnant students, from housing and scholarships to on-campus child care. Following repeated requests to complete our survey, 17 Catholic universities out of 64 responded to our questions about how the universities handle support for pregnant students. Of those, a majority said they allow pregnant students to live in dormitories, and 7 have family housing for after the baby is born. A majority of these schools do not have on-campus child care. As we've already shown, the University of Mary in North Dakota serves as a role model for other Catholic campuses. And while many of the 17 campuses already had resources available before 2022, some felt a new push to help mothers in a post-Roe world, with an emphasis not just on pro-family resources, but pro-family attitudes. The Catholic University of America here in Washington, D.C. launched their Guadalupe Project following the Dobbs Supreme Court decision. Their mission? To create a place of radical welcome for families on campus. Jenny Lichter, Deputy General Counsel at the Catholic University of America and Chair of the Guadalupe Project Committee, calls it a whole campus effort, listening to the needs of faculty, staff, and students.
Since we launched the project last June, we've already implemented a number of actions that we hope makes life a little bit easier for all of the families in our community and makes celebrating life a little bit more fun.
Some of those efforts include parking spaces for pregnant women, baby items in the university's cupboard, and maternity wear at the university's clothing exchange, Cardinal Closet. And to make sure students never forget what resources are available, posters advertising resources have become part of the wallpaper in campus halls.
Just to really drill home that message of support, and the university will walk with you. Life is a gift, and we're here with you.
Lichter says the university has received a lot of good feedback from parents and graduate school.
It's been interesting to see the specific deliverables to which people reacted, especially in the short term. And it really drove home that for parents, especially for moms, the little, seemingly little, but like very practical things make such a difference.
Like many Catholic colleges, the Catholic University of America has a code of conduct that emphasizes chastity. But Lichter makes clear, pregnant students will not get into trouble.
And in a sense, that seems obvious, right? But in a moment of panic or something that's experienced as a moment of crisis, we just didn't want there to be any question in the minds of any student on this campus that they would need to be hesitant to seek help and support from the university for any reason.
Initiatives, big and small, all helping Catholic spaces encourage a culture of life and making a huge difference in the lives of young parents.
And so if we can make sure that people aren't thinking, I have to choose between being a mom and getting an education and being able to provide for myself and for my family, if we can sort of break apart that false choice and instead provide opportunity as a loving community of Christians and Catholics, then we're going to do that.
Catherine Hadrow, EWTN News In Depth.
The programs mentioned in our report don't stand alone. I'm joined by Debbie Capon, Executive Director of MiraVia, which provides housing for pregnant college students in the Charlotte, North Carolina area. Debbie, thank you for being here with us. MiraVia provides more than just housing. After a mother gives birth, they are allowed to stay until the child is 2 years old. What else do you provide these mothers?
We really provide comprehensive support. I mean, the tangible things would be, of course, like you said, the housing, the meals, the child care. life skills classes, referrals to services, weekly meetings with a case manager to help them to stay on track with their goals. And then there's also all of the intangible things, such as, you know, the peer support, the friendships that they're making, a sense of normalcy and being integrated in the community. And all the while, you know, every need is taken care of, from diapers to wipes to, you know, cribs, car seats, strollers, everything they need.
That's amazing. And Miravia is located on the campus of Belmont Abbey College in Charlotte, North Carolina. But students don't have to be specifically enrolled in the college to receive this benefits. Is that correct?
Yes, it's very unique. You know, we have built this facility with the generosity of the land donated by Belmont Abbey. And so far, the students have come, we've really become a destination. They've come from 9 different states, 12 different colleges. And by the time that they complete the program, overall, we've had 41% enroll at Belmont Abbey College before they leave. But they really, we want them to stay on the track that they were already on to minimize the disruptions and help them to get to their goals faster.
And how many students are you currently helping? Have you seen an uptick in the number of women choosing life since the launch of the program?
Yeah, this year we had 8 student moms. And, you know, as far as the uptick, it's not as much of a measurement of that as it's what we have seen is really the impact on the culture on colleges, you know, and that's what we want to see as well, that not just for our clients, but we want to see that uptick in overall attitude towards pregnant students and embracing them. And we hear it over and over again from our clients that their friends and their teammates are so impressed with all that they're doing. And it has changed their viewpoint on what they would have done personally if they had an unplanned pregnancy in college.
And if you wanted to measure a success rate of these students in getting their degree, is that something that is easy to measure?
Yeah, when they are with us, we have 100% success rate. While they're with us, they are advancing their degrees and getting towards their goals. And overall, 75% of our moms graduate either while they're with us or within 2 years after leaving us. And so we could not be more proud of these young women. Just this weekend, we had 5 moms cross the stage and get their diplomas.
Oh, that's wonderful. How engaged are the students on campus then in what you're doing? Do they volunteer? Is this something that's a really active ministry for them too?
It really is. Belmont Abbey has just set this beautiful example of embracing these moms. Everything from surprise baby showers in their classrooms to coming and babysitting, volunteering, you know, the sports teams come out and do projects. Professors invite us to come and speak to their classes. And it really is this beautiful relationship between the two organizations.
Well, that's wonderful. Thank you so much for your work, Debbie, in this field. It's making a serious difference.
Thank you. It's our honor.
Loretta Brown, a reporter for the National Catholic Register, collaborated with the Catholic News Agency and EWTN News In Depth on this report. She joins me now to give us a little more insight into our joint reporting project. Loretta, it's so great to have you here. I'm so proud of this report and the ongoing reporting that will be happening as you keep track of these colleges. So you were making these phone calls alongside a couple of other people, but only 25% of these colleges responded. What did you learn from those who did respond?
Of those that did respond, there was definitely accommodation kind of on a basic level for these students who became pregnant. So 15 out of the 17 schools that did respond had pregnant students could remain in the dorms, for example, right? They had those housing needs met. And of those that didn't have that option, there was a separate accommodation for off-campus housing, right? So no one was losing their housing that instant or anything like that. However, it was smaller numbers with some of these more specific accommodations. So 11 out of 17 those schools had lactation rooms, for example, a nice accommodation for student moms. And then 5 out of the 17 had on-campus childcare resources, which I think is a huge part of, being able to balance student life and motherhood.
Right. That's true. Well, what do you think are the challenges for universities and colleges trying to set up programs similar to Miravia?
Well, from what I've seen and kind of heard, funding can be a key part here. Is depending on the size of the school and the funding, they have to make some of these decisions about
what they can do, what their resources can afford. And I was inspired to see some creative solutions. You know, certainly some of these schools had volunteer babysitting networks of, you know, student volunteers,
right,
where, yeah, they're not maybe breaking the bank, but the community's getting involved and they have this incredible resource of childcare available.
That's really important. So then, do you think that the wake of Roe being overturned, these policies with abortion being banned in different states, that that's going to both increase the need, but also the interest from these colleges and universities to get involved?
Yes, absolutely. I think it will both increase the need and the interest. And that was some of the feedback I was hearing, even within some of these specific survey responses, where schools saying, oh, yeah, if this situation arose, or to think about, oh, you know, we are actually looking, we're assessing what more we can do. And I was very inspired, you know, talking to, for example, Catholic University of America. They used this kind of as a wake-up call. They said, okay, we need to look at what we have and what we can offer. And it's an ongoing thing. You know, they're still receiving feedback and still seeing what can we add. So I think, yeah, some of these schools are doing soul searching in this moment on this.
That's great. Well, we look forward to following up with you so we continue looking into these policies and then also providing students the choice to choose a campus that is going to treat mothers and life in this way. Thank you so much, Loretta.
Thank you, Monse.
Of course. To see Loretta's coverage and other writers' coverage of these programs, check out the websites of our sister organizations, the Catholic News Agency and the National Catholic Register. Still to come, a ministry that hopes to heal the deep wounds of adult children of divorce. We speak with the founder of the ministry about why he created it and what the path to healing looks like.
The scope and scale of the violations this report documents are nothing less than disheartening.
Imprisonment, torture, and genocide. A report calls attention to the millions who are persecuted for their religious beliefs. The countries where conditions are worsening next.
And songs from dozens of Ukrainians living in Rome to welcome the arrival of Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky last Saturday. Zelensky met with Italian officials during his brief visit to Rome, and for the first time since the war started in February 2022, he met with Pope Francis, greeting him with his hand over his heart and calling it a great honor. The two discussed the continued humanitarian need for those suffering from the war before exchanging gifts. Pope Francis gave Zelensky a bronze olive branch, and Zelensky gave the Holy Father artwork entitled Loss, representing the killing of children during the war. Pope Francis has said that he's working behind the scenes to broker peace, but neither Russia nor Ukraine have confirmed that statement.
Religious persecution, it's on the rise. Believers are suffering in countries like Cuba, China, and Iran, as they have been for decades. But there's also new persecution in countries like Nigeria, and really egregious in Nicaragua.
The tightening grip of regimes, dictatorships, and militant groups is leading to the erosion of a fundamental right to religious freedom in countries across the globe. The U.S. Commission on International Religious Freedom has released its 2023 report assessing government policies worldwide that lead to the repression or persecution of people of faith. This year, 28 countries highlighted in red and orange were placed on the countries of particular concern list or the special watch list. Each list tracks varying government engagement in or tolerance of religious freedom violations. Some of those countries include Sri Lanka, Turkey, India, and Nicaragua, where priests and bishops have been thrown in jail.
Nicaragua is a case of extreme violence against the church in a place that's predominantly Catholic, which is very unusual. Since, I think, in the last 5 years, there have been almost 530 acts of violence against the church.
The chair of the U.S. Commission on International Religious Freedom, Nuri Turkel, joins us to break down this report. It's great to have you back on the show, Nuri. Let's start in Nicaragua. The Missionaries of Charity, an order established by Mother Teresa, were kicked out of the country last summer. We saw multiple Catholics, Christians, and political dissidents imprisoned, including Bishop Rolando Alvarez, who's still behind bars. The U.S. did intervene, negotiating the release of many of those prisoners who were then brought to the U.S. What else is the U.S. government doing in the wake of these injustices?
Thank you very much for having me on. The 2022 report on religious conditions in Nicaragua reports a worsening situation that is very concerning to us. The government of Nicaragua, under the President Daniel Ortega and Vice President Murillo, escalated its campaign of harassment and severe persecution against the Catholic Church by targeting clergy, eliminating church-affiliated organizations, placing restrictions on religious observances, and in engaging in hate speech against the Catholic Church. So these are the things that we are very concerned. As a result, we have recommended Nicaragua as a country of particular concern for the first time. From 2019 through 2022, we recommended Nicaragua as a country that should be on the special watch list. Mm.
Is there anything that could be triggered from that recommendation?
The Ortega regime continued to detain, imprison the individuals affiliated, associated with Catholic Church, including Bishop Alvarez that you pointed out. Government also shut down 3,000 non-governmental organizations, including numerous church-affiliated NGOs, civil society organizations, and media stations. Government also, again, expelled priests and prevented them from returning to the country after traveling abroad without any official explanations. And finally, regime continued to arbitrarily ban Catholic processions in several cities, often for reason of internal security, which is a very common excuse for countries or regimes that persecute their own religious communities.
Well, it seems things are only getting worse. And we're seeing things getting worse for Christian communities attacked in Nigeria last year as well, including a bombing at a Catholic church that killed 40 people on Pentecost Sunday. We're going to get to that anniversary soon. And another 100 Christians killed this year. What are USERF's recommendations to protect Christians in Nigeria?
You know, the situation in Nigeria is very, very worrying. It has taken a disturbing trend. Since my 3 years with the commission, I have been advocating raising the cases of a Nigerian Christian community with the senior officials, both in previous administration and current administration. As an organization, as a government agency, we have recommended Nigeria for CPC since 2009.
Wow.
Boko Haram, for example, was recommended as an entity of particular concern since 2020. Islamic State in West Africa has been recommended as an EPC since 2021. So I sincerely hope that the administration will listen to us. This is a very concerning situation, that there's an actual atrocity crimes being committed against the religious communities, particularly the Christian community. So because of the government's inaction, government's unwilling to address this these serious issues, the situation in Nigeria is worsening. It's only, you know, in the past we were talking about non-state actors committing acts of violence,
mm-hmm.
But now it's becoming rampant. You know, it's happening pretty much everywhere, and also people who have been criminalized for even not following a certain type of religious practices. So this is very concerning. The United States government must put aside geopolitical interest and do the right thing. If you don't stop this, we will end up seeing similar type of atrocity crimes being committed to other vulnerable groups.
Mm-hmm.
In the last 50 years, the ethno-religious groups have been subject to crimes against humanity, ethnic cleansing, war crimes, genocide. We have to lead.
Right.
You know, as Secretary Blinken often says, the world does not organize itself, and the United States must lead. I cannot agree with Secretary Moore on this point. On this issue, the religious persecutions in other parts of the world, the United States must lead, because at the end of the day, we're the only country with the resources, with the government agencies, offices, and willingness, and with a long history of defending religious liberty, religious freedom, and this is where we need to show up.
That's right. Nuri, well, let's talk about those other communities really quickly. As a Uyghur Muslim, you've seen your people suffer from political indoctrination, imprisonment, enforced labor camps, and even genocide in China. The USURF report indicates that Muslims, Tibetan Buddhists, underground Catholics, and house church Protestants are especially vulnerable to persecution there. Why does it seem that the world is tolerating this, and what are your recommendations?
Oh, you know, simply put, that's a hypocrisy. Chinese Communist Party happened to be a wrong type of adversary or a government or communist political party for the international community to take on. And one particular group, you know, the Uyghurs are getting enough attention for a wrong reason. We've been talking about a genocide that has been ongoing last 7 years. The United States government has done has taken a number of significant decisions, but because it's been just the United States and the business community is still being complicit in the ongoing crimes against humanity and genocide in the Uyghur homeland, where this practice is still ongoing. But one particular group that I wanted to highlight, underscore, is the Catholics in China. The Vatican must speak out against the persecution of Catholic communities. The Catholic Church and China has this mysterious agreement that has been renewed multiple times. And in one provision in that agreement, allowing the Vatican to have a saying in the appointment of bishops in China, must be honored. And also Vatican and our government and other governments, like-minded governments and allies and partners, must speak out, must pressure the Chinese to stop Sinicization of religious texts, particularly Bible and Quran.
Right.
And also we need to pressure the Chinese to stop forcing Catholics to sign up with the Catholic Patriotic Association. That is an arm of the Communist Party. Communist ideology and religious belief are incompatible. The CCP has figured that out, but the Western liberal democracies are lagging behind. We need to do the right thing to protect the Catholic community in China.
Well, Nuri, we're grateful for your advocacy and for your clarity around this, and we hope that everyone will speak up on these horrific and egregious violations of human rights. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much for having me on.
The USURF report gives robust descriptions of religious violations globally. You can read it by visiting www.usurf.gov. After the break, predicting divorce. A new report shows a common trend many couples take part in that could mean they're more likely to separate. We'll be right back.
Basically, what we try to give is give some dignity to the people that are on the streets, you know, and empower them to make a change.
Support for those living on the streets. The program helping homeless individuals find security, love, and opportunity. That story ahead.
Marriage. For Catholics, it's a sacrament. In the eyes of the Church, the bond of marriage cannot be dissolved. Only an annulment can allow a couple to break that bond. Nonetheless, many Catholics do get civil divorces. According to the latest data from the Centers for Disease Control, there were more than 689,000 divorces and annulments in the U.S. in 2021. That was across 45 states. California, Hawaii, New Mexico, Minnesota, and Indiana were not included. Studying divorce rates and reasons for divorce can be tricky. It's a complicated issue, and there can be many factors that lead a couple to want to end their marriage. A new study suggests that living together before marriage can lead to a greater chance of divorce. A study by the University of Denver for the Institute of Family Studies found that 34% of married couples who cohabitated before getting engaged got divorced. Comparing that to 23% of couples who cohabitated after engagement also ended in divorce. That's an 11% greater likelihood of a marriage ending if you live together before engagement. Brad Wilcox, professor and director of the National Marriage Project at the University of Virginia and senior fellow at the Institute for Family Studies, joins us now to talk more about the nuances of this study. Brad, thank you for being with us. The Church certainly does not condone cohabitation before marriage, but as we know, a lot of couples do it. What are the main reasons that couples are moving in together before marriage now?
Monse, I think what we're seeing today is a lot of folks are kind of testing the waters, trying to figure out if this person's a good prospect for marriage down the road, even kind of a serious commitment as well. But then also seeing too, a lot of couples are just kind of looking at cohabitation as sort of a way to, you know, kind of basically save money, you know, have a more convenient setup in their young adult world. So those are kind of the two, I think, tracks we see in the research by and large.
So either trying to test things out from a fear of commitment or financial reasons. The report mentioned making a clear commitment. Can you elaborate on that?
What we do see is that couples who kind of take things more slowly and deliberately, and who basically are trying to figure out if they have, you know, the basis, the foundation for a strong friendship and commitment, are more likely to flourish. And so more particularly couples who wait to go out until after an engagement, or especially obviously couples who are waiting to move in together after the wedding, are the kinds of couples who are more likely to be flourishing in their marriages today.
How has diversity of cultures, diversity of languages in our country affected this? Is there a cultural difference that stops people from being able to communicate and find that common ground to marry?
Yeah, I think one of the things that we see among young adults in general, and certainly young adults here at the University of Virginia where I teach, is there's a kind of a confusion about kind of how to go about dating and mating. We don't have many kind of common customs to sort of orienting adults today. And so in a world where there are few rules, you know, few scripts to abide by, many young adults think that cohabiting with someone is the best way to sort of figure out if they have a future together.
And Brad, then what advice does this report offer for a successful marriage?
We see, I think, both in this report and just more generally, is the couples who, again, kind of take things slowly, who kind of deliberate together about their future, who look for a common foundation of friendship, and who postpone cohabitation until at least an engagement, but I would say particularly until the wedding date, are more likely to be flourishing in their marriages, and they're more likely to avoid divorce court. And one of the sort of strongest findings in the report is of kind of accumulating a kind of a set of kind of experiences involving multiple cohabitations with more than one person is particularly risky. It's those folks who live with more than one person, more than their spouse, who are especially likely to end up in divorce court. So of course, the easiest way to end up avoiding that scenario is just to wait until after the wedding day to live together.
Brad, really quick, what can communities do? I know that grandparents and parents worry about their children and how they can foster a desire for commitment, but also just strong relationships. What can they do?
I think kind of it's really important to kind of educate your kids before, you know, they hit 20 years old, to kind of let them understand and appreciate how much marriage matters for their future. What I see in my research is that kind of marital quality is the number one predictor of global life satisfaction for Americans. So to kind of given that kind of reality, kind of give your sense, you know, give your kids a sense of sort of how important it is to kind of basically approach, you know, dating and sort of finding a spouse with the same degree of kind of intentionality and seriousness of purpose that you do oftentimes with, you know, your schooling and your career future. And if you kind of, you know, take things seriously when it comes to dating, looking for someone who has kind of, you know, some important measure of character, who shares your faith, for instance, you're much more likely to be flourishing when you go ahead and put a ring on it.
Really good advice. We suggest everyone put a ring on it. Thank you so much, Brad.
Thank you, Monse.
We continue our discussion on divorce after the break. I'll speak with the founder of a ministry that helps adult children of divorce learn how to heal. Stay with us. Welcome back. We continue our conversation on the impact of divorce with a look at how it affects children, specifically the wounds adult children of divorce carry. According to some estimates, 50% of children born into married families today will witness their parents' divorce. The effects can last for decades. Varying studies show adult children of divorce are more likely to have difficulty maintaining close relationships, have lower oxytocin levels, have a higher risk of smoking, and face a greater risk of divorce themselves, just to name a few. Healing is difficult, but it's not impossible for adult children of divorce. One ministry specializes in helping them find support and resources for overcoming this pain from within the church. Dan Miola, the co-founder of Life-Giving Wounds, and Father John Paul of the Franciscan Missionaries of the Eternal Word and chaplain for EWTN, join me now to talk about this, the importance of this ministry. Thank you so much for joining me, gentlemen. Dan, what are the first steps toward healing when adult children of divorce have carried these scars for so long?
Yeah, I'd really take Paul's admonition to anybody who's facing suffering to grieve with hope. 1 Thessalonians 4:13. So there's a lot of adult children divorced who wonder if they have any wounds because their wounds have been minimized, ignored, or silenced for all sorts of reasons. So just to offer them to have the permission to grieve and explore that this may in fact be a wound. And to those who already know that they're wounded, but maybe are facing kind of a resignation that there's no hope for healing, is to have hope and to invite Christ into this pain.
That's beautiful. Father John Paul, as a priest, what advice can you offer those seeking consolation through prayer?
Well, prayer is the most important thing, Monsi. And I would say that every one of us has a story. Every one of us has a very unique story and our own individual experience of what we may have gone through with our own parents' divorce. And like you said, to be very sensitive with that, but also to face it in reality, to bring it to the Lord in prayer, and know that God's story, his own story of salvation, must intersect with our story. So bringing our brokenness, our wounds to the story of salvation, and really, in all honesty, bringing our hurts, our pains, our wounds to the wounds of Jesus, because his wounds are fresh wounds. His wounds are resurrected wounds. And that's really the method in prayer, is bringing our humanity and our brokenness to Jesus' own humanity and his wounds that are in eternity forever open for us.
For us to enter into them. That's beautiful. Dan, what does peer support look like in this ministry? I know a lot of people, they're hesitant to even talk about divorce. They're worried about hurting other people, hurting their parents. What does it look like to do this in community?
Yeah, I mean, we can't do this healing work alone, as Father Jean-Paul Mary just mentioned about inviting Christ, but Christ also wants to incarnate his presence in a community, and we know the surest way to healing and virtues through friendship. So the peer support we offer in our ministries through small group discussion, through advice from others who know the pain from the inside, who know the path of healing from the inside. So we try to provide these encounters, and ultimately we hope friendships with other people who are similarly wounded so we can heal together. We just have seen the fruits of this again and again, the importance of the uniqueness of peer support for this wound. So that's kind of what it looks like, whether that be in retreats or support groups, etc.
Father John Paul, we know that the Holy Father talked about a lot of marriages not being valid, and he also made the annulment process easier. What does the church need to do in response to divorce?
Everything. Everything possible. Just from the very beginning of family life, the way we're raised, the way we are taught the faith, the way we're taught to communicate with one another, openness in marriage, love. I think it's so important that it begin very early. And also, not just marriage preparation is very important, but also accompanying married couples probably within the first years of marriage, 5, 10, 15 years of marriage, to have other couples along the road with you. You can't do it alone. Just like in religious life and priesthood, you can't do it alone. Married couples need examples in those early years, the years where they might struggle with different things, to help them through those things, to make really divorce unthinkable.
Absolutely. Dan, we know adult children of divorce can view marriage with a skeptical eye. How do you overcome that and approach this sacrament with an open heart?
First, just to dovetail on the last question, is we really need to listen to the stories of adult children of divorce. We need to hear their voice and really truly get to know this group intimately, to know their struggles with marriage, their fears, I feel like so often the church misses this voice. So first of all, just listening to what are their challenges so we can respond effectively in pastoral ministry to help them move towards a vocation of marriage. And also, I might say, consecrated life and priesthood. They struggle with a skeptical eye towards all these vocations. So first of all, just listening more to their voice and responding to their particular pain. Second of all, they need to recover an adequate view of marriage. We often have a damaged view of marriage from our experiences of a broken home, and the church offers a beautiful blueprint for that. And then lastly, to also be aware, grow an awareness of the wounds and the ways and effects that negatively impacts relationships with relationship harming behaviors, some of which we're often not even aware of. And for this, we also need help with mentors of other adult children divorced who have been there, who have struggled similarly, but can offer hope that yes, you can have a great marriage too, even if you come from a broken home, and to learn how to do that. It takes work, it takes effort, but with God's grace, anything is possible, and many of us do go on to have beautiful marriages, but we need to cooperate with God's grace, recovering the blueprint, listening to the voices of other adult children divorced, having specific pastoral ministry for them and their fears, and then offering some mentor couples.
Father John Paul, listening to that, all of the things that the church can do and needs to do, is it also about restoring the relationship between the individual and Jesus Christ and fostering that first?
Yeah, that's a great question, Monsi, because Jesus Christ is the bridegroom and the church is his spouse. And so, like, marriage is that imagery here on earth, that foreshadowing of the imagery between Jesus Christ and his church. And that image between Jesus Christ and his church is indestructible. You can't break that bond. So, like, marriage, when we enter into marriage, for those who are married, and also for those of us who take vows in religious life, we're to live our life based on Jesus' relationship with his church, which is a total gift of self, offering everything back to God.
It's a very, very different way of looking at relationships. I know with this culture, it can be a challenge. So I'm grateful to both of you for this ministry and for your personal testimonies. Thank you.
Thank you, Monsi, for your opportunity.
Thank you.
If you or someone you know would like to learn more about this ministry, visit lifegivingwounds.org.
I got a house, I got a roof, I got a bed, I got a place to cook, I got good roommates, you know. It's like another family, you know.
The path towards a brighter future for those who were once homeless. The nonprofit organization working to help them reintegrate into society.
Homelessness knows no bias, and the circumstances are often complicated. Regardless of race, gender, or background, there are many people who sleep on the streets every night across the U.S. EWTN News In-Depth's Colin Flynn traveled to Miami to get a glimpse of the growing homeless crisis there and the work being done to provide shelter to those in need.
Famous for its beautiful weather, pristine beaches, and vibrant nightlife, the city of Miami offers a slice of the good life, earning the nickname the Magic City. But behind the glitter is the grit.
People being priced out of their homes because of rising rents, leading to a rise in the homeless population in South Florida.
Could be a solution to the city's homeless crisis.
More than 1,000 people are estimated to be living on Miami streets, and a further 2,500 in shelters. They end up on the streets for a number of reasons. Many are immigrants who have come from South America to chase the American dream, lured to Miami because of its large Latino and Spanish-speaking population. Others are Americans who suffer from alcoholism, drug addiction, and other problems.
Let's go to a shelter. Who wanna go?
This is the story of a group who are helping the homeless. A Catholic nonprofit organization called Hermanos de la Calle, or Brothers of the Street. They go out at night to meet the homeless, offering them food, shelter, and counseling. Narciso Munoz is the founder.
We started like 7 years ago.
Why?
I was trying, you know, to have like a special connection with God. I feel the call, but especially because I have a lot of kids and I want to show them where Jesus was.
Faith in action.
Faith in action, and to try to see Jesus in other people, you know.
Tonight, Narciso and his group of volunteers are in a small park in Miami, known to be a hotspot for those sleeping rough. This man has just arrived from the Dominican Republic with his son. He tells me that they've been traveling for months through countries like Peru, Ecuador, and Colombia, walking some of the way, getting help for other parts of the journey.
Somebody give me $40, somebody give me $20.
He says he finally made it to the US border in Texas and then got a bus to Miami. But here they have no family or connections.
I want to make money for my son so he doesn't suffer like I suffered.
A priest with the charity tries to console the upset and frightened father while Narciso and his team arrange a hotel room for them for the night. But with so little accommodation available in Miami, finding them a long-term solution will be a challenge. Narciso Munoz's daytime job is in finance, and he admits that he didn't always have such a kind view of the poor.
I used to judge people, you know, for the money that they have, for how they dress, whatever. And sometimes, as we met with this Dominican man, who is a good father, who is a good man? He's doing everything for his kid.
Now, for the past 7 years, his ministry has helped hundreds of people on the streets of Miami.
Basically, what we try to give is give some dignity to the people that are on the streets, you know, and empower them to make a change.
Noticing that one of the biggest challenges to people on the street was getting back into the housing system, Narciso had the idea to rent houses in different parts of the city where the homeless could live together as housemates and under supervision support each other to overcome their addictions and other challenges. It's late in the evening, and in one of the houses, a group of men are sitting around a table and having a weekly support meeting, talking openly and honestly about the struggles they've faced that week. One of the men living in the house is Anders, who is from Miami but lived in Tulsa, Oklahoma for a number of years.
20 years of drinking. Oh, really? Yeah. So it was time to put a stop to it.
And what kind of problems did the drinking lead to?
Loss of jobs, loss of family connections, loss of home. You know, it was just one problem after another.
Anders says he drank away everything in his life and had reached rock bottom.
Oh, I was scared. I was terrified. You know, it was like one of those where you just don't want to live anymore.
Another one of the houses has 10 men living in it. They're all expected to be self-sufficient, pay a portion of the rent, and help with the upkeep of the house. This gives them a sense of ownership and responsibility. Luis is from Puerto Rico and is one of the residents who came here from the streets.
Nobody wants to live in the streets. I just thank God every day that I'm here. I got a house, I got a roof, I got a bed, I got a place to cook, I got good roommates, you know. It's like another family, you know.
It's all spiritual.
Wow.
Gongolo is from Chicago originally and is another one of the residents who came here after spending 15 months on the streets. He shows me his shared room.
This side is mine.
And this is a...
pictures of my family.
Wow.
When I was younger with my father, my sister, my nephew, my granddaughter, well, when she was younger today. I look at it a lot, think back. It, you know, sometimes it's good, sometimes it's not.
The way I look at life and think about it now is totally different from the way I was used to living. I feel good. I feel good. Like I said, thank God. I'm just happy.
The charity Hermanas de la Calle is doing what it can to help the homeless population of Miami. But in reality, it's a constant struggle with more and more people needing help. And Narciso Muñez still works full-time in a bank, but says his new calling in life has given him a sense of purpose.
God gave me a lot of blessings. I need to share them. Don't worry, I'm not here to judge. If you take a shower, you dress okay,
maybe you find a job. And once you find a job, you can pay for your bed. And when you can pay for it, you can pay for the supermarket. And then you're back in society.
And for the ones who are able to get off the streets and those who are able to break out of addiction, now they look to the future with hope and dreams.
God willing, I'll be moving back to Oklahoma here in a couple of months. You know, with, you know, now that I have some sobriety in me, and you know, that's all I gotta do. Just stay sober.
Stay sober. I know. Easier said than done.
Yeah.
But one day at a time.
Exactly. That's what we. One day at a time.
In Miami, Colm Flynn, EWTN News in Depth.
It's hard work to recover from homelessness and to help others recover from it. But the goal is change, reintegration, and independence. That does it for our program this week. Tune in next week, same time, same place, for more news and reports important to your Catholic faith. See you then.